Welcome to Now. I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Aisha Khalid.
They were once a wonder drug, but are antibiotics losing the war against disease?
We are seeing greater than 2 million episodes of antibiotic-resistant infections in people each year in the U.S. alone. And 23,000 of these episodes result in death.
We'll meet some people who are helping to fight the after effects of trauma in the developing world.
I mean, you see this in children of Holocaust survivors. Traumatic depression can go from one generation to the next. And unless you treat it, it's still there.
Do children benefit from being in same-sex education?
Can you imagine a plastic that repairs itself?
There's new hope for those with spinal injuries.
That's all coming up on this Wednesday edition of Now. Last week, the World Health Organization issued a sobering report that said we are losing the fight against antibiotic-resistant disease.
The WHO report said the world could be entering a post-antibiotic period.
As VOA's Carol Pearson tells us, that means that some common bacterial infections no longer respond as quickly or at all to drugs that used to contain them.
Bacteria are tiny living things, neither plant nor animal. Some, like bacteria in yogurt, are good for us, but others, like those that cause cholera and tuberculosis, are deadly. Before the World Health Organization published its report, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control reported that some bacteria no longer respond to antibiotics like they used to. Dr. Laurie Hicks is with the CDC.
And we are seeing greater than 2 million episodes of antibiotic-resistant infections in people each year in the U.S. alone. And 23,000 of these episodes result in death.
Dr. Hicks says if there are messages the CDC wants to get out, one is...
We want doctors to know, first of all, that antibiotic resistance is a big problem.
And here's another.
We want patients to know that antibiotics don't work for viral infections.
Antibiotic resistance already has changed the way medicine is practiced in hospitals like Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. Doctors there are now more cautious about how they use antibiotics. They review treatment plans to see if patients are getting the right antibiotics and the right dose. Dr. Trish Pearl is an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Medicine.
You all of a sudden understand what it was like to practice medicine maybe 50, 70, 80 years ago when there weren't antibiotics.
Nearby at the University of Maryland Medical Center, doctors have changed the way they care for patients in the intensive care unit. MRSA is an antibiotic-resistant staph infection that spreads easily, especially in an intensive care unit, and it can be deadly. Dr. Anthony Harris studied whether having healthcare workers wear gloves and gowns in intensive care units could reduce the number of infections. His study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Wearing gloves and gowns for all patient contact led to a significant decrease in MRSA acquisition, accounting for about a 40% decrease.
Dr. Pearl says money is needed for research so health workers can understand how these organisms are spread. New drugs need to be developed to take the place of those that no longer work. And patients also need to be educated.
Resistance commonly develops when people skip medications or, you know, take it one day and not the next, or they don't really think they need it, so they only take half of their course. And that's been particularly problematic with diseases like tuberculosis.
Solutions need to be found fast because the World Health Organization warns that antibiotic resistance is a problem so serious that it threatens the achievements of modern medicine. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Aisha, I understand the overprescribing of antibiotics is a problem in Pakistan. You were telling me that?
You are very right, David. It is believed that antibiotic overconsumption is more prevalent in the underdeveloped and developing world than in the developed world. I myself have experienced and witnessed this phenomenon growing up in Pakistan. Question is, what leads to this overconsumption of antibiotics? I asked this question of Mr. A.Q. Javed Iqbal, who is the Director of Quality Control at Drug Regulatory Authority of Pakistan. Take a listen.
Irrational prescribing is one of the major causes because they do not practically depend on the lab report. Self-prescribing is one of the major problems, and people sometimes do not use antibiotics as they should use it. And the other thing which government is now getting conscious that the promotional activities by the pharmaceutical industries need to be checked to the level that drugs and the medicines like third or fourth generation antibiotics are not wrongly promoted.
So what the official is saying is that awareness is lacking, not only in the patients, but also in the health professionals.
Now, growing up in Pakistan, what was it that you experienced that alerted you to this practice of overprescribing medicines?
I was diagnosed by a very prominent physician in Islamabad of UTI, or a urinary tract infection, several years ago. He started me on a 14-day course of very strong antibiotics, even where without waiting for the results. When the results came, turned out I never had the infection. Yes. However, the good thing was that he told me to finish the course.
Now, you know, this official that you quoted, Mr. Iqbal, he mentioned about marketing is kind of the reverse of the U.S. situation. Here in the United States, companies, drug companies, have curtailed their marketing of antibiotics, or they've even stopped research and development altogether because they don't make enough money off of them.
No, I think it's still the opposite in Pakistan.
Yeah, because, see, here companies have stopped antibiotic research because, you know, you take antibiotics for maybe a week or maybe 2 weeks, and then you're done with them. But it costs billions of dollars to develop new drugs, to go through all the testing and the research and development, all that kind of stuff. And so the drug companies want you to be taking drugs like heart medication or cancer medication or, you know, chronic illness medication that you will have to take for a long time, because that way they make more money.
Yeah, things are improving in Pakistan.
Right.
You know, there is not as much of the overprescription or even the self-prescription. Awareness is increasing.
Now, how can somebody self-prescribe a drug? Here in the United States, you might not pay for them. I see signs in the store, sometimes free antibiotics, but you still have to have a doctor write the prescription.
David, this is the disturbing thing. In the smaller cities and towns, many antibiotics are still available over the counter. People don't need a doctor's prescription to buy them. However, this practice has been controlled for the large part in big cities, and now it is hard to get antibiotics without a medical doctor's prescription. Still, the problem of overprescription by the doctors persists.
So what do you think? Let us know your opinion by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. Aisha, did you ever experience any trauma, sudden trauma kind of thing growing up?
In 1988, you know, we had this blast at this big ammunition depot in Rawalpindi, which is the twin city of Islamabad.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
And I was preparing for my high school exams. So if you would call it a trauma, I would say, yeah, I went through a trauma.
Well, were you injured in that?
No, I was not. But, you know, it happened in the city, and we were hearing, you know, very loud blasts, and we were hearing the news of people, you know, like in the next street getting killed.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, and getting blown up even after, you know, several years of that. Bombs were, you know, discovered. You know, kids, by mistake, they will dig them up.
Oh, yeah.
And they will get blown up.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Well, see, now that kind of
goes... But personally, I was not, you know, affected by that trauma.
Yeah, well, that kind of goes on to an ongoing sense of you're not safe, though.
Yes,
which
you're
can
right.
be traumatic in and of
but
itself.
But it was so close. It was so close.
Well, you know, the news is full of reports of trauma, whether it is natural disasters or war or tragic accidents.
One family in New York who lost a relative in the September 11, 2001 attacks decided to do something to help people who have suffered trauma.
As VOA's Carolyn Weaver found out, the foundation that they started is establishing trauma clinics in poor countries scarred by violence.
New Yorker Liz Alderman and James Okello, a psychiatrist visiting from Uganda, would never have met if not for tragedy. Her youngest son, Peter, was killed in the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center.
He did not work in the building. He was there just for a meeting, and he was 25 years old when he died. My husband and I needed to create a memorial for him, to leave a mark that he had existed and that the world would be a better place because Peter had lived.
Watching a TV show one night, she stumbled on the idea of bringing mental health care to people in poorer countries traumatized by mass violence and terrorism. The first Peter C. Alderman Trauma Treatment Clinic opened in Cambodia in 2005 and was so overwhelmed with patients that a second clinic was established nearby the following year.
People often ask us, why are you seeing patients in Cambodia? I mean, Pol Pot was, what, 30, 35 years ago? Traumatic depression doesn't go away. I mean, you see this in children of Holocaust survivors. Traumatic depression can go from one generation to the next, and unless you treat it, it's still there.
In Uganda, where there are four clinics, patients include many former child soldiers and others abducted into war over two decades by the Lord's Resistance Army. James Okello directs the clinic in Gulu in the north, which helps patients through counseling, group therapy, and psychopharmacology.
I think almost every trauma, if there's no form of intervention, definitely there's going to be a problem. We also sometimes talk about delayed post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, that there's usually the concept that when the guns stop firing, then the mind starts firing. So a lot of these things happen when the emergency situation is long gone.
The clinics are set up in partnership with governments in each country and staffed solely by indigenous healthcare givers who understand traumatic mental illness, both in medical terms and according to local culture.
We use cultural idioms to express the same Western symptoms. So I think anybody that is not culture literate, you know, if you do not understand a certain culture, you are likely to miss a lot or to even overdiagnose, depending on which tool you're using.
The foundation also has a clinic in the Kibera slum in Nairobi, Kenya, and has worked in Rwanda, Liberia, and Haiti. It funds a new medical publication, the African Journal of Traumatic Stress. Alderman says more than 200 indigenous healthcare professionals have been trained, who have gone on to teach others, and care has reached more than 75,000 patients. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
If you would like to learn more about the Peter C. Alderman Foundation, you can log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And you can post your comments to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And we're also on Twitter. Our address there is at Now VOA Show.
Tomorrow way too far away, and we can't get back yesterday. But we young right now, we got right now, so get up right now, 'cause all we got is right now.
David, did you go to public or private school growing up?
I went mostly to public schools all the way through college. I did go to private school a couple of years, but mostly it was public schools. How about you?
I went to government primary schools. Primary schools are the ones that we call here as elementary schools. Mm-hmm. And it was a coeducation.
Okay, so it wasn't boys only or girls only. So you didn't go to a girls only school?
In the middle school, it was a girls only school. And again, in college, it was a girls only college.
Oh.
But in university, again, it reverses. We have coeducation in the universities.
Oh, okay. See, my schools were a mixture of races and genders. I never went to what would be called an all boys school.
As VOA's Julie Tabo found out, there is some controversy over whether or not students learn better at same sex schools.
Anaira Clavijo likes school and hopes to be a fashion designer when she grows up. The 10-year-old attended kindergarten in a co-ed classroom, but for the past 5 years, she's been at Excel Academy, the first all-girl independently run, taxpayer-supported school in Washington. Anaira says she prefers being in an all-girl school.
They make me feel like I'm loved and I'm like the smartest person in the world. Boys are rough and they like to do other stuff than girls.
Excel Academy, which opened its doors in 2008, offers a free, academically rigorous program to a mostly low-income community. It serves more than 600 girls, from preschool through grade 5. Kay Savage is Excel's founder and chief executive officer.
Oftentimes in co-educational settings, teachers teach to the boys. They're a little bit louder and much more active than the girls. And girls end up becoming second-class citizens in their own classrooms and in their own schools.
The data really isn't there to support any claims about advantages from single-sex education.
Galen Sherwin is with the American Civil Liberties Union and disagrees.
We know that the similarities between boys and girls are much greater and more relevant than any differences. Certainly any differences that exist are not relevant from an educational standpoint.
A key factor for educational success is early development, says Economic Policy Institute education expert Elaine Weiss.
Everything that happens in those early lives, from how stressed or non-stressed their mother was during pregnancy, how nourished she was, whether they had access to a quality pre-kindergarten program, all of those things prepare them more or less for kindergarten.
And while Kay Savage says Excel Academy's gender-segregated classrooms make a difference, Weiss says other factors at the school have a bigger impact.
They start, for example, in preschool. So they're addressing some of that early gap before kids get to kindergarten. They keep their classes relatively small so that teachers can have a one-on-one conversation and interaction with students. They have enriching after-school opportunities.
The school also provides 3 nutritious meals a day. And Naira Clavijo isn't sure if she'll continue in an all-girl program, but for now, she's happy where she is.
I think I feel more confident in what I'm saying and what I do around my friends and around my teachers.
And that's exactly what educators at Excel Academy are striving for. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
So you mentioned that you went to an all-girls school in what we would call high school or secondary school. Was that better that, you know, rather than going where it's mixed boys and girls or young men and young women? Because, see, I went to a public high school where it was young men and young women mixed together and, you know, chasing girls was kind
David,
of one of the things.
Had you asked me this question when I was a student, I would not have been able to answer this question. But, you know, in my other life, I was also a teacher.
Oh,
and
okay.
I taught middle school, which was co-education.
Right.
And there were boys and girls both under the same roof. And I felt that, both sexes being in the same classroom created a lot of issues, you know, for those young, growing teenage minds, which were, you know, already going through a lot.
Minds and bodies, by the way. I remember being quite distracted about the time I was 13.
Yes, I felt that it made, you know, their lives more complex at that time.
Well, what do you think? Do you approve of single-gender colleges, or would you rather send your child, like Aisha's son, would you rather send your child to a school that has both boys and girls? Let us know by sending an email to voaasia@voanews.com. Severe spinal cord injuries usually lead to total loss of control of your lower extremities, as well as your bladder, your bowel, and even sexual functions.
But scientists at the University of Louisville in Kentucky say an implanted electrical device is helping the patients regain at least some of that control.
As VOA's George Putich tells us, these implants offer hope to people who have lost some of their feeling and function.
A dirt bike accident 5 years ago left Ken Stevenson paralyzed from the chest down. Doctors told him that he would never be able to stand up again.
They said based on what they've diagnosed and how I broke my back and everything, that I wouldn't be able to move my legs again or feel anything ever again.
Another blow to the young man was the loss of sexual function. But now, thanks to a small device implanted in his back that electrically stimulates his spinal cord, Stevenson has regained some ability to enjoy activities he thought were left behind forever. Dr. Roderick Pettigrew of the National Institutes of Health explains.
The goal was to modulate those damaged nerves in the spinal cord so that they once again would become receptive to a stimuli.
The stimulator is turned on with a remote control and allows Stephenson to move one leg at a time, other functions improved too.
The sexual function thing was huge for me. I mean, because it was basically nothing before. And I mean, now, like, it's a lot better.
Three other patients reported similar improvements, although none of them can walk. Pettigrew stresses that the device is not a cure and that more research is needed before it can be widely available. But he says a spinal cord injury may no longer mean a lifelong sentence of paralysis.
What we see today with these four individuals now being able to have voluntary motion and voluntary control of their limbs and involuntary control of functions like bladder and bowel is very exciting.
The researchers now plan to implant the device in 8 more patients and try to stimulate more than one muscle group at the time. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
If you would like to see video of some of these spinal implants, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And we'd love to hear your comments. You can post them to our Facebook page, VOA Asia, and we might read your comment on the air in a future show.
And don't forget, we are also on Twitter. Our address there is @NowVOAShow.
The human body's capability to repair itself is nothing short of miraculous. But what about other materials, like plastic?
Scientists at the University of Illinois Urbana have developed a material that will repair itself.
As VOA's Jessica Berman found out, scientists use the human circulatory system as their model.
Imagine a sheet of plastic with a tear or hole in the middle. Suddenly the breach begins to fill in. Within seconds, the hole is completely covered with new plastic material. In a couple of hours, the plastic is as hard as ever. Central to this regeneration process, according to inventor Scott White of the University of Illinois Urbana, are parallel vascular-like channels through which liquid repair material is funneled onto the damaged plastic. A big challenge in the development of the self-regeneration system was gravity, which would make the repair material leak out. But scientists developed two chemicals which mix and congeal immediately after reaching the damaged site. The material then fills the hole or crack in the plastic by folding on top of itself until the entire breach is patched. White says scientists got the idea from the human circulatory system and the body's use of platelets to repair a wound.
If we have a major gash, you know, there's a possibility that we could bleed out, but if that gash is not too severe, then we should see a blood clot form, and then the repair process takes place underneath that clot. And this is the same kind of principle here.
Self-healing plastic could be used in a number of ways, White says. For example, it could be used as a protective coating on metal.
If you had a regenerative coating, in this case, you could basically walk away and be assured that there was always going to be a coating on that substrate and never have to worry about corrosion process happening anymore.
White, a professor of aerospace engineering, says that might be useful on the decks of ships, which commonly get scraped and dinged, causing rust to form, or as a coating on car bumpers to repair dings and scrapes. White says the research is in the early stages. Currently, the repair is visible, but in time, he says, it'll be difficult to see where the damage was after the plastic regenerates itself. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
If you would like to see video of this self-repairing plastic, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And if you have a question or comment about this story, visit our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And we are also on Twitter. Our address there is @NowVOAShow.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of Now.
If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard on our show, log on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
If you'd like to hear the program again, or maybe just a certain segment of it, log on to our website, www.voanews.com/now, We're also on iTunes.
And we are on Twitter as well. Our address there is @NowVOAShow.
Patrice Martin produces our program.
The managing editor of VOA English is Diane Gao.
Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Aisha Khalid.
Join us again Monday for another edition of Now.